Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Some forces in America are pushing for what is called a family diversity policy, understanding that all families are basically equal and deserving of the same rights and all the rest. And there is an agenda behind that, of course, and that is to redefine the family away from what is rightly described as the natural family of the mother and father and their children, and then out from that the extended family, to this family diversity that would include same-sex couples with their children, all kinds of things like that. But here's the question. Is this new policy of family diversity going to include polygamy? We're not going to be talking just about some slippery slope theory today. We're going to be talking about actual proposals being made and questions being raised about why polygamy is wrong. It's been in the news with the Yearning for Zion Ranch and the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints. It's been in the news because the numbers on polygamy turned out to be far higher than many in America had estimated. And now there are people asking the serious question, why is polygamy illegal? If same-sex marriage is now being made a matter of law in California and in Massachusetts, how can it be that polygamy is, in and of itself, illegal? We'll be talking about it today on the Albert Mohler Program. We'll be looking at the worldview and the logic behind this and what it represents. First, to review some other issues in the news, of course, over the last 24 hours, America has been giving a great deal of attention to the opening night of the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado, for good reason. I just hope most Americans understand that what's going on there is a scripted television program, and a bipartisan sense, you need to understand the Republican convention will be just the same. We're not looking at the drama of big decisions pending. We're looking at the laying out and playing out of certain platforms and themes and pictures and images and emotions that the parties want to associate with their candidate and with the party's future. Last night was Michelle Obama's opportunity, and in my view, she delivered a very capable speech. She probably hit all the points that were intended. She personalized it. She probably went some way toward personalizing Barack Obama, her husband. But time will tell. People do not elect presidents on the basis of the potential first lady. Now, this is not a spousal election. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Obviously, it was cute to have the Obama girls out there. And we should always celebrate when there's a picture of a healthy family and a wonderful, respectful, loving family. That's something all of us should appreciate, all of us should admire. And so in that picture, there was nothing not to admire last night. It was, of course, scripted in terms of dad showing up on the video and the girl saying, when are you going to be here and all the rest. But let's face it, sweet is sweet. And so it was a good night for the Democrats in terms of setting the stage with that agenda. It was also a very powerfully poignant night last night with the video by Ken Burns concerning Senator Edward Kennedy. I was shocked by his appearance. I was expecting him to look weak. I wasn't expecting him to look quite so classically weak and bloated and just physically infirm. But I have to just preface everything I say about Ted Kennedy by saying it'd be hard for me to find someone with whom I am probably in disagreement, very strong disagreement on so many issues, as is the case when I think about my views and convictions and those of Senator Edward Kennedy. But we're talking about a human being here, a human being who has given himself to public service, whose votes and legacy in that respect I do not respect and appreciate, but whose willingness to give himself to public service I do admire. I have to say last night I admire the fact that he had the courage to show up knowing that he was in weakness rather than in strength. It had to be emotional for the senator, and it had to be emotional for all those Democrats for whom the Kennedy family is such a powerful symbol, with the knowledge that, given the diagnosis of this terminal cancer, it will be a remarkable thing if Senator Kennedy were to survive to be present for a future convention in 2012. So we're looking here at a benediction and valediction of sorts from Senator Kennedy. So America was riveted last night, and the ratings appear to be very strong. That is something a little different than perhaps in the last couple of election cycles, but there is much at stake here. And I think because of that, Americans are really going to be giving a lot of attention to what goes on in Denver. And, of course, tonight, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton will be addressing the Democratic National Convention. And then tomorrow night, former President Bill Clinton. And then Thursday night, of course, we'll be hearing the acceptance address from Senator Barack Obama as he accepts the nomination of the Democratic Party for president. In between time, very little drama, but kind of like when you are watching a television program you've seen before, you're reading a book you have read before, you're watching a play that you have viewed before, you know how it's going to end, but sometimes it's still fascinating to watch even when you know what everyone's going to say and what everyone's going to do. That's pretty much what's going to happen. Hillary Clinton is going to find a way to give her full endorsement to Senator Barack Obama. Bill Clinton will, I'll go in on a limb here, find a way to try to bring himself back into the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And Barack Obama, I think I can promise you this, will accept the nomination of his party on Thursday night. Again, I go back to the fact that I would encourage Christian families to watch this together. I think there probably is a tendency on the part of some families to say, my kids don't need to see that. I just want to argue to the contrary. I think you all viewing this together would have a great basis for some conversation about issues that do matter. You can also help your children to understand the difference between the real and the perceived, the scripted and the spontaneous, and to be able to take some of these issues back to their ultimate question, which is, what would this candidate do in office? Beyond all the bells and whistles and the very impressive kind of stage work that you see there in Denver, and I'm sure you'll see in Minneapolis, the big question is, what would be the net difference if this person were elected president of the United States? What worldview would drive him, guide him, shape him? And in this race, that's a very legitimate question. And with two candidates, you'll come up with two very different responses to that question. At my website at albertmuller.com this morning, I posted an article entitled From Mainline to Sideline, The Death of Protestant America. I consider it to be about a very important article written by Joseph Bottom, whose theory is that America was once not only a religious nation, not only a Christian nation, but an essentially Protestant nation. This is what he writes. He says, America was Methodist once upon a time, Methodist or Baptist or Presbyterian or Congregationalist or Episcopalian. But as he makes clear in his article, that was then and this is now. What we have witnessed over the last several decades is the absolute collapse and implosion of mainline, or what is sometimes called mainstream, Protestantism. Those are the more liberal churches, the brand names of Lutheranism and Methodism and the Northern Baptist, now the American Baptist churches, and such groups as the Presbyterian Church USA, the Congregationalists that are now the United Church of Christ, and then, of course, the Episcopal Church U.S. We've been seeing all of those churches marching steadily to the left. Joseph Bottom writes that America as a social experiment has been a stool, that's his image, a stool that rests on three legs. The first leg is democracy, the second leg is capitalism, and the third leg was Protestant Christianity. He argues that American culture has been vital because Protestant Christianity gave to the nation a moral narrative and a vocabulary of meaning that enabled us to all know about our shared values and the rest. But that has all disappeared. As he says, the riverbed has run dry. He says this. He says, even while we may remember the names of the old denominations, we tend to forget that it all made a kind of sense back in the day, and it came with a kind of order. The genteel Episcopalians high on the hill and the all-over Baptists down by the river. Oh, and the innumerable independent Bible churches tangled out across the prairie like brambles. Through most of the nation's history, these endless divisions and revisions of Protestantism renounced one another and sermonized against one another. They squabbled, sneered, and fought, but they had something in common for all that. Together they formed a vague but vast unity. Together they formed America. But over the last three or four decades, these churches have been marching steadily to the left, and they have been hemorrhaging members. Their membership is now, in some cases, almost a fraction of what it was just a few years ago. Now, Joseph Bottom is concerned about this in terms of the future of the American experiment. He's concerned with how America will have a shared worldview sufficient to operate as a society, a shared worldview sufficient to create enough meaning for us to live with each other and have the kind of shared vocabulary that is necessary for citizens of one culture. He suggests that both evangelical Christianity and Roman Catholicism are inadequate because neither has enough hold on the entire nation to form a replacement for where mainline Protestantism once was. But I'm more concerned about the church itself. The future of the culture is certainly an issue of importance, but to me, the future of the church is far more important. I have to look back with lament on the fact that these mainline Protestant denominations were the churches that fueled the great missionary enterprise of the Christian church at mid-century. They planted the churches that in so many cases were the mainline establishment, recognizable, faithful churches and communities. It is nothing less than a great theological and spiritual tragedy that these denominations have abandoned the faith, accommodated themselves to the culture, and moved themselves to the sideline. I think Joseph Bottom's theory is entirely correct. I think America is weaker because of the disappearance of the Protestant mainline. But far more than that, I think that the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ has been weakened by apostasy and accommodationism, not from without, but from within. And evangelicals, we better be watching with care lest the same thing happen to ourselves, our denominations, and our churches. We'll be right back on the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Wendy Kaminer is one of the most interesting liberal theorists in America today. She writes for some major publications. She recently published an article that just simply asked this question, why is polygamy illegal? And that caught my eye. I decided I wanted to take a closer look at what she's arguing here. So let me just read to you from her article. She says this: opponents of gay rights often warn that legalizing same-sex marriage would inexorably lead to legalizing polygamy. Maybe it would, and maybe it should. Okay, now, all you have to know is those two sentences to know this article is going to be interesting. Here you have someone well-known in the political world who's saying not only that the legalization of same-sex marriage might lead to polygamy and its legalization, but that it should. Or at least maybe it should. She goes on to write, denying gay couples the right to marry violates state constitutional guarantees of equality, as the California and Massachusetts high courts have rightly ruled. The Supreme Court of California also held that the right to marry is fundamental. Surely Mormons have the same rights to equal treatment under the law, and of course they have a substantial First Amendment claim to engage in multiple marriages according to the dictates of their faith, period. Okay, just a little insertion here. Because I'm bracing myself, I know if we do not say this rightly, we will get mail. And that is, we want to make clear that the current teaching of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, more commonly known as the Mormons, is that polygamy is wrong and is not to be practiced. It is also the historic truth that that was required of the Church, along with the criminalization in the territory of Utah, at the end of the 19th century, in order for Utah to enter the Union as a state. That was the price of statehood. And then, of course, the entire question of the legality of and constitutionality of polygamy was handled by a case from the U.S. Supreme Court that finally made the issue very, very clear. All right, that's the Reynolds versus U.S. case. All right, so let's back up a little bit more. However, there are offshoots. What would be considered as unofficial or even perhaps they would use the word heretical branches of the Mormon tradition that do practice polygamy, such as the Yearning for Zion ranch that, of course, is of what is self-identified as the fundamentalist church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So you look at all that, and I had to put in that footnote. Wendy Kaminer here says that those, let's just say those who wish to do that, let's just call them that, those who wish to be polygamous, she says, should have an equal right to be polygamous as those who wish to be homosexual have a right to engage in same-sex marriage and to have those unions legalized. But she also makes the point that right now, for instance, say a homosexual couple to enter into a union and to consider themselves married, even if they do not have a marriage license, and right now homosexual marriage per se is basically limited to Massachusetts and California, she makes the point that they're not thrown in jail, but a polygamist is. Very interesting article. She goes on and she speaks of why polygamy might not be such a bad thing for society. Speaking of the Supreme Court's decision in the Reynolds case, she says, today the court's analogy is anachronistic as a ban on adultery. After all, what's the difference between an adulterer and a polygamist? And if it's not illegal for a married man to support a girlfriend or two and father children out of wedlock with them, how can it be illegal for him to bind himself to them according to the laws of his church? Okay. let's answer her question. I mean, she's very serious. This is not a joke. She is not suggesting this as some kind of mental or intellectual exercise. She's saying, look, what's the difference between our conception of adultery? Adultery, she would accept many people believe is wrong and is a sin, but it's not illegal. No one is in jail per se for adultery. And she goes on and says, listen, an adulterous man could keep a lot of girlfriends on the side, could father children by them, and could even economically sustain them and function as husband and as father. But the moment he somehow officially begins to recognize that, he commits some kind of crime. She says that doesn't make any sense. You know, every once in a while you confront an argument that illuminates where we really stand in this culture. And then this is one of those. This is the kind of argument, I mean, let's face it, she is using adultery to argue for polygamy. She's using same-sex marriage to argue for the extended definition of family beyond even homosexual unions here to polygamous unions. But I have to back up and say this is the logic. I mean, here we face the kind of unvarnished logic of absolute relativism on the family that many others are aiming at but try to hide. There are a lot of people that come close to this kind of argument, but they back up because they feel they have to. It would be horrible public relations for them to press on with this kind of argument. But it's not only Wendy Kaminer who's arguing this, and she does so in a very, very articulate piece in which she's raising all these questions. Let me read to you the end of her argument. She says, I'm simply pointing out that the state should not abuse the power to prosecute people or forcibly remove their children because authorities don't approve of their, quote, lifestyle. Gay men were once routinely suspected of being pedophiles, a suspicion that persists today, but with considerably less prevalence and respectability. Indeed, opposition to gay marriage still relies on specious arguments about the harm it poses to children. Some fools still compare homosexuality to bestiality, just as the Supreme Court once compared polygamy to human sacrifice. We progress when we base the extension of rights on reason, not bias or judicial hyperbole. So here's Wendy Kaminer saying, look, the Supreme Court's decision on polygamy is unsustainable. The court compared it to child sacrifice, human sacrifice. And she says, no one's going to take that seriously anymore. And she goes on to say, look, why is it illegal? And this is the key to her argument, because the Supreme Court didn't like it. That's why it's illegal. Sometime back, Jonathan Turley wrote an article in USA Today. So here we're moving even closer into the mainstream. Jonathan Turley, by the way, is the Shapiro Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington Law School. And if you watch much of the cable news, you certainly see regularly appearing there, Jonathan Turley. Writing in USA Today, he says that eventually polygamy will have to be legalized as a matter of equal treatment under the law. He goes back also to the Reynolds case, the decision in 1878 when the Supreme Court refused to recognize polygamy as a legitimate religious practice. But now we find out, says Turley, that indeed it is. Speaking of it as a First Amendment right, a religious liberty right, Jonathan Turley, a major constitutional lawyer, writes, given this history and the long religious traditions, it cannot be seriously denied that polygamy is a legitimate religious belief. Since polygamy is a criminal offense, polygamists do not seek marriage licenses. However, even living as married can send you to prison. Prosecutors have asked courts to declare a person as married under common law and then convicted them of polygamy. Fascinating stuff here. And I think both of these articles serve to illuminate the challenge that's now before us. Here's what it is. We, as Christians, believe that marriage is not many things, but one thing. We believe that the family can demonstrate all kinds of different patterns of brokenness and extension or reduction, but the essence of the family is what is rightly called the natural family, sometimes previously called the nuclear family, in which case you have a married mother and father, a man and a woman, and their natural offspring, and any offspring they may adopt, and then out from that, the extended family of kin, grandparents, cousins, aunts and uncles, and all the rest. We believe that that's not just something that is the product of human social evolution, but is indeed a pattern, even an institution, that God has given us by His grace, for His glory, and for our good. Those who argue that marriage and thus the family can be, in essence, some other thing, are going to be hard-pressed by Wendy Kaminer and Jonathan Turley to say why it can't be polygamy. Join the conversation by calling 877-893-8255 on the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My challenge to you is very simple and direct. How would you answer Wendy Kaminer when she asked the question, why is polygamy wrong? And then why should polygamy be illegal? How would you answer that question? This is no longer hypothetical. This is now being discussed in law schools. As a matter of fact, I have before me right now two law school journal articles dealing with this very question, coming to the same conclusion, and that is that there probably is an inevitability to the legalization of same-sex marriage and of polygamy. But how would you answer the question? Why and how is this wrong? Why should it be illegal? Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Also, we'd love to hear from you by email responses to mail@albertmohler.com or go to albertmohler.com, hit the mail button. It will get to us. The phone number again is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Sometimes these questions can seem remote and abstract, but let me put it in a context we can all understand. You're driving home from the soccer game. Mom and dad in the front seat, kids in the back seat. 12-year-old son pipes up, what's polygamy? 14-year-old sister says, you ought to know what polygamy is. That's when a man has more than one wife. 12-year-old son thinks in his head, now that's an interesting concept. Then he pipes up, is that wrong? Mom says, oh yeah, that's wrong. Then he says, why? Okay, mom and dad in the front seat, answer the question. For that matter, 14-year-old sister in the back seat, I'd love to hear from you too. Why is that wrong? That's a serious question that demands a serious answer. And we as Christians better think intelligently about how we would frame the answer to that, because it is no longer a remote and abstract question. It is the kind of question that's going to show up in your car, at your dinner table, at your workplace, at your church, or on your college and university campus. Not just talk in the dorm, but conversation in the law school. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have calls coming in from across the nation, and your call could be next. That's 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I mentioned that I have these law review articles before me, and indeed I do. And these two articles, by the way, are from the University of Houston School of Law in Texas. One of them is entitled, Polygamist Eye for the Monogamous Guy, Homosexual Sodomy, Gay Marriage, Is Polygamy Next? That's an interesting title just to have setting forth the kind of issues being faced. The next article is, Why Just Have One, an Evaluation of the Anti-Polygamy Laws Under the Establishment Clause? Now, reading these law journal articles, something becomes very clear, and that is that the legal basis used by many people to suggest why polygamy is wrong is that there is a harm to women and children, an inherent harm. And, of course, the government claims a right to be able to step in, especially in the role of protecting minors, and say they cannot give consent to this, and if there's a harm that they suffer, then the state has a right to say that that this practice or institution may not continue. I think they're going to have a very hard time making that argument when women, as adults, we're not talking here about girls who are not adults and do not have adult responsibility and adult decision-making authority, but when women old enough to give consent say this is what they want, I think just given the way we have begun to escalate autonomous human rights, it's going to be very, very difficult for a court to say no. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to go back to the car, where 12-year-old boy is asked the question, why is polygamy wrong? I guarantee you there probably aren't many 12-year-old boys asking that question who at that point are beginning to contemplate polygamy, but they are wondering what in the world is going on there, and he deserves an answer. Why is it wrong? Let's go to Sellersburg, Indiana. Doug's on the line. Why is it wrong, Doug?
Well, it depends on your frame of reference. If you have a Christian worldview, when you lose sight of the truth that God has given to us, then anything can be right or wrong as society dictates. You get the differentiation between morals and ethics that no longer align in a society that denies that there is a sovereign God who gets to make the rules. It's the same answer regardless of the topic if you want to go against the will of God. You have to have a Christian frame of reference for anything to be effectively right or wrong.
Well, I agree with that, but let's say you have to make this argument at the Supreme Court. Would you try to make the argument, or would you say just legalize polygamy?
It's going to be a function of society. I don't know how you effectively argue that when society says it's okay. We've decided as a society we're no longer a Christian nation, therefore might makes right. That's really what it boils down to.
Yeah, but it's very interesting, though, Doug. You certainly are right about the necessity of a Christian worldview, especially in the background. But it's interesting that even in Western Europe, highly secularized Europe, they're not ready to legalize polygamy, and for some reason. I'll tell you why when we come back. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. How would you answer the question, why is polygamy wrong? And Doug very helpfully suggested, as a Christian, there's a very clear answer, the Christian worldview, based upon God's gift to us in His own Word. His revelation tells us what marriage is, and on that basis we come to understand that marriage is an institution given by God. And thus, for Christians, that's clearly understood. But when you start to move into the secular arena, that's where I have to press the question and say, how would you make that argument? And I'm going to suggest that as Christians we still have to make that argument. Same thing against same-sex marriage. And I think that argument has to be that civilization itself has learned that the institution of marriage as the union of a husband and a wife, as a reproductive pair in the main, and privileging that relationship and their children is essential to social cohesion. And that once you begin to undermine and subvert the institution of the family, certainly the institution of marriage, you enter into a conspiracy against yourself to undermine the very fabric of the society. Now, Doug suggested that that might not be compelling over time, certainly to people who reject a Christian worldview, and that is being lived out among us. I mean, that's true. The more the Christian worldview recedes in the culture, the less compelling even that kind of argument is. Moving from even scriptural revelation to natural revelation, in other words, to what we learn just by observing nature, there are people who will deny that because they are determined to follow their sin. There's still time for you to call and tell me what you think. How would you answer the question, why is polygamy wrong? Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. In Umpqua, Oregon, Jerry's on the line. What do you think, Jerry?
Hi. Well, my wife and I are both Christians. We've actually had this discussion a lot. I don't think in the Old Testament you can find any place in the Old Testament where it says you're supposed to just have one wife. I think it's a wise tradition to only have one wife. And here in America, where we can't even hold on to one, I think two would be ridiculous. But having said that, when we decided to give rights to a sexual preference, we opened up Pandora's box. And it's my belief that it won't be too long in the United States where any type of sexual relationship is going to have rights. And that will include polygamy. It will include the gay lifestyle. It will include pedophilia.
You know, Jerry, I fear that that last part of your argument may come true in our time. And, you know, the distinction being made right now by people is that consent is the only moral issue, and that's why pedophilia would be wrong, because children are not old enough to give consent. But what any – and you've heard this before, haven't you? What consenting adults decide to do is their own business. I think that may be indeed where we're headed, and I certainly agree with you about the abhorrent vision before us if that be true. Now, Jerry, I have to say, I have to go back to what you said at the beginning, however, in suggesting that you're not finding any clear biblical teaching about monogamy rather than polygamy being God's expectation. Now, the background of that is, of course, we had in the Old Testament some of the patriarchs who took multiple wives. And you look at that and you say, well, were they right or were they wrong? Well, I'm going to suggest that they were wrong. And I think our authority for that is Jesus Christ himself. So let's just very quickly do a little summary here of why I would make the argument from Scripture that polygamy is wrong. First of all, Genesis 2. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. You don't have to know much Greek to know that mono means one, monogamy, one flesh. There's a one flesh relationship that is identified there in Genesis as a part of God's plan from the beginning. Now, that's all we had. We might miss the point, but that's not all we have. You go to the New Testament, and the metaphor of Christ and the church is a monogamous relationship. In other words, marriage becomes a central means of understanding the relationship between Jesus Christ and his blood-bought church. The church, made up of all the believers throughout all the ages, is indeed described as his bride, his only bride. And the mono there is very important in monogamy. There's only one. Then we have the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, and this is where he is asked questions concerning divorce. And let me just read to you. It begins in verse 3. Some Pharisees came to Jesus testing him and asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason at all? And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? He said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. In other words, this is, of course, reading Jesus here, reciting Genesis. And then in verse 6, Jesus says, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. So here Jesus says, concerning divorce, he said that wasn't God's plan from the beginning. God's plan from the beginning was one man and one woman in the unity and the monogamous covenant of marriage. And so that's the argument I would make. And then there's one further argument I'd offer, Jerry, and that is that every reference to marriage in the New Testament assumes a singular marriage. You look at the household codes found in the letters, for instance, of Paul in Colossians or in Ephesians chapter 5. The reference is clearly to a wife. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where Paul's dealing again with marriage, it's about a wife, one marriage. So I think there's more there than you may have seen, and I'm going to argue that we as Christians have every reason to understand why polygamy is wrong. I also want to point out that when you go to a place, for instance, in Africa, where polygamy has been an ethnic custom, one of the big issues for the advance of the gospel in those nations is how do we deal with polygamists who come to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ? So, for instance, I talked with an Anglican archbishop who is himself African dealing with this question, and he told me about 5 years ago, he said the issue is how we deal with this. We come to the conclusion that when a man who is a polygamist comes to faith in Christ, we order him to be faithful to all of his wives, to protect them and to take care of them, but to be sexually related to only one of them, his first wife, but to be economically and in every other way the one who takes care of the other wives and children. But polygamy is then a sin, so no one is allowed to then in those churches to enter into a polygamous relationship once they have come to faith in Christ. Very quickly, I want to go to Jim calling from Michigan. What do you think, Jim?
I agree with you completely scripturally, but I see a social unraveling, economic unraveling of everything we've got. I suspect, or I fear this is going to be even bigger yet. We're assuming it's going to be one man with multiple wives. Imagine a one woman with multiple husbands. Now we've got overlap taking place, insurances, and on and on and on.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting point. By the way, polygyny is the technical term for a woman who would have multiple husbands. It turns out that there's not much demand for that through human history. It turns out that men seem to prefer multiple wives more than women preferring multiple husbands, but that doesn't take anything away from Jim's argument, which is that when society unravels, it unravels as a totality. I think that is an essential point to be made here. If you allow one thing to be called marriage when it isn't marriage, then you've opened the door for anything to be called marriage. You normalize one aberrant relationship, you've got a catalog of other relationships just waiting their turn in line. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. That was a very interesting conversation. I appreciate our callers and all others who participated in this conversation. Going back to how I set up the question, I hope the 12-year-old boy in the backseat of the car has at least a hint of an answer as to why polygamy is wrong. Wrong, first of all, because the Scripture makes clear that it's wrong in holding forth the norm of heterosexual monogamy within the covenant, the sacred covenant of marriage, as the expectation and as the picture that Christ will use indeed of his relationship with his church. But there are also natural law arguments to be made here, arguments from history, arguments from human experience about what happens when you have the natural family subverted by social forces. And that's really what we're facing now. And it may be that it will be some long period of time, tragically, before this culture learns anew the cost of subverting the family. We have to hope not. We have to hope that some moral sanity will prevail here. However, the article by Wendy Kaminer, the article sometime back by Jonathan Turley, and this raft of Law Review articles indicates that it may be hard to stem this tide for some time. At my website at albertmiller.com, as I said, I posted an article this morning there at the blog entitled From Mainline to Sideline, The Death of Protestant America. But at the reading list, I posted a review of David F. Wells' book, The Courage to be Protestant. And listeners to this program will remember that back in June, David Wells was our guest. But I listed this because this actually not only has the coincidence of the word Protestant in the title, along with that of my main article, it really makes the argument about how we can stay distinctively Protestant in terms of holding forth the truth of God's word and the power of the gospel. The subtitle of his book is Truth Lovers, Marketers, and Emergence in the Postmodern World. And you start looking at that and you say, yes, that's exactly how you can see the topography of the evangelical movement right now. You have truth lovers, those who believe that the gospel is defined by truth and that the church must be established by a normative commitment to truth. And then you have those who are really trying to substitute a truth-centered message for something that they believe can be better marketed to a secular culture. And then you have the emergence, oftentimes not only concerned with the marketing of those in the more seeker-sensitive movement, but moving on to a more aggressive embrace of a postmodern worldview, along with a very different conception of truth at the most fundamental level. I really commend to you David F. Wells' book, The Courage to be Protestant. By the way, that is the fifth book in a series. And at my website at albertmiller.com, under the reading list posted today, you will find links to how you can get all five of those books. Well worth your reading. Let me also remind you that my new book, Atheism Remix, is out, available at your local bookstore or at online sources. It is a confrontation with the new atheism that I hope will be helpful to Christians in thinking about how to answer the questions posed by this new challenge. Tomorrow's Ask Anything Wednesday in the Albert Miller program. Back tomorrow with your questions. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.